Hi friends, welcome back to another episode of Colts, Killers, and Cocktails with Jen and Vanessa.
Please be advised, the following episode is for mature audiences only. We talk about content that may be triggering to some individuals and contain discussions regarding rape, murder, sex, suicide, religious organizations, and disturbing situations.
Now, let's get into this week's episode.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Colts, Killers, and Cocktails.
I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Jen.
This is episode 12.
Yes.
Episode 12. We did it, guys. And thank you so much for all of our followers on Instagram. And thank you for everybody that's listened to us. We're officially over 1,000 listens and 1,000 followers.
Woo!
And we are so excited.
We are pumped.
Yes. So do you have any life updates this week, Jen?
I'm trying to think if I did anything cool this week, but no.
You're always just so cool.
I'm so cool. I am going to go see A Quiet Place 2 this weekend, and I'm super pumped. Hi, Yoshi.
And that was Yoshi sneezing / coughing. A Quiet Place 2.
Yeah.
What's that?
A Quiet Place, the scary movie. The second one's coming out this weekend.
Is that that one with Jim?
Yes, and Jim from The Office.
Yes.
What about you?
So, I don't really have updates, but I'm trying to look for more, like, serial killer instances in my life that I can share on this podcast, and I have a couple.
What happened?
So, I was taking Yoshi on a walk, and this red little tiny car, like a little Toyota Corolla or something, slows down next to me with his windows down. He's like, "Looks like you got your guard dog on you, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah, that's what I tell everybody." And greyhounds are, like, super skinny, and they are not, like, biting dogs or whatever. But I just told him to get away from me, but he kept following me.
Weird.
And he was, like, literally following me all down the block saying, like, "That's a beautiful dog."
Thank you. Have a good day, sir.
Thank you. Can you please leave me alone? So that was one experience. And then yesterday I had somebody, like, banging on my door and ringing my doorbell, and I looked in the driveway and it wasn't Amazon. So I don't know if it was that same guy, like, trying to come to my house.
Yeah, that's creepy.
I have a security system, and I don't live in a bad area.
Right.
So I don't know what's happening. It's probably the universe getting back at me for karma, so whatever.
It's cashing in.
I don't know what I did.
All right, well, are you ready for this week's tale?
I am. Let's do it.
Have you ever heard of Terry Tilly?
No, but I love his name.
I know, right? Say that, like, three times fast. Terry Tilly.
Terry Tilly, Terry Tilly.
Oh, man. Okay. So, our tale today takes place in Montflanc in France. And just to preface, I'm probably going to mispronounce a lot of these things, but I'm going to try my best, but it's probably going to be the Americanized version of all of these sayings.
Cool.
Perfect. So, Montflanc in France, if you guys don't know about it, is one of the most beautiful and well-preserved medieval towns in France. So, just put that in the back of your head as we're talking about this. In Oxford, a woman that was in her late 50s is sitting in her room. She has not slept for days, or at least if she did, it wasn't for very much. People are taking shifts watching her and berating her. She is beaten, only given one meal a day, drugged, can't bathe or use the bathroom unless on her own free will. Who would do this to her? Well, this would be her friends and family, of course.
What?
Why would a family do something so horrible? Well, that's because they thought that she was the one. The one that had the ability to unlock their future and give them their destiny. She was the one that had a special power in her head. In her head, she knew a number to a bank account in Brussels that would lead to a secret to save the world. She wanted this to be true, so bad, more than anything that she ever wanted. But she couldn't take it anymore. After the days and days of not resting, being beaten, and just the torture, she decided to make up a number, and her family was so happy. They finally treated her like normal, and when she thought it was all over, they took her to Brussels and made her go to each bank to try the account number. None of them worked because obviously the account never existed.
So they're beating her because they think that she's like the keeper of all secrets. Why would you beat somebody up?
Because it's going to make her remember the account number.
Oh, yeah, because that's how I remember my debit card pin.
Right.
Yeah, totally.
So let's backtrack a little bit. This family was none other than the Vidrines. They were a large, well-respected family. They were French aristocrats, which is pretty much the upper class of French society.
Kind of like the Aristocats.
Right, yeah, I was thinking that too when I read it. So these people came from royalty long ago, but it doesn't necessarily mean they have a ton of money. This family in particular had to work, so they weren't super rich, but they also lived in, like, a mansion.
That's kind of weird, royalty, and you have to work. I mean, nowadays you don't ever hear about, you know, royalty working.
Right. Well, these are aristocrats. They're not, like, prince and princesses. It's not like the Princess Diaries, you know, where she, like, automatically goes into this fortune.
Gotcha.
So this was such a nice family. Their friends and neighbors loved them. They were pretty normal. They organized parties. They would have cookouts, music festivals, just kind of like your day-to-day things out in France. Guillemette, who actually died later in 2010, was age 97, and her children, Philippe, was 64 years old. He was an executive with Shell Oil, to show you what type of jobs they had.
Oh, wow.
Charles was a gynecologist and also a politician on the side. What a mix. And then their sister, and her name is spelled G-H-I-S-L-A-I-N-E. And
Giseline?
Kind of, that's how I would want to say it, but they were, like, pronouncing it as in, like, Giselle, but we're just going to call her G.
Okay.
G was the one who actually was the first person to meet Tilly. G was in charge of a school. She had a lot of responsibility, and she needed someone to come in and pretty much help with, like, the IT part of it. And that's when one of her lawyer friends introduced her to Tilly. He was very, very useful around the school. He did a great job with the computers and everything and quickly impressed her. He also claimed to be a descendant of an Austro-Hungarian Habsburg nobility, which was kind of interesting because that noble family was known for, like, incest.
Oh,
so
ew.
If you were going to pick one or say you're related to it, that's not the one I would pick.
No, not at all.
But, yeah, he said that his communist grandmother had held salons with former social president Francisco Mitterrand. So, like, he's saying that he knows all these people and he has all these high connections. So he told her that he had all these high connections and had all these ways to make money, that he was very well off. And this made the family and her hold him in high esteem and keep wanting to get to know him more. So she invites him over to dinner, introduces him to the family. They talk to him, and they're all super, super impressed. The guy that introduced her to Tilly, Vincent David, was a lawyer that she knew, and he even backed him up saying he was a successful businessman. For her, she wanted her sons and everything to be successful too, so she even had her son, like, intern for Tilly.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. At the school, it was pretty much close to bankruptcy, and it was really, really stressful. Plus, she was having problems in her marriage at that time, and Tilly was there for her. He came up with ways to help with the issues at school. He was a sounding board for her marriage, so she would talk to him about all of their issues. And after a while, she did not make a decision without him. For 3 years, he kept building her trust and the trust of everyone in their families. For example, after he met the family, he moved one house over and lived there for a year and would visit the family every single day, talking to different members of the family.
He bought that house on purpose?
He rented it, yeah, just to be near them.
But, oh, no.
Yeah. And when this happened, they started trusting him more and more and more. Mr. Vadrine said, at the beginning, Tilly just said that he would look after their home, you know, if they were gone or anything like that. They also had tons of investments and trusts. He said that he could do a better job. He was promising a 10% return on an investment, which if someone promised me that, I would gladly sign up with them because that's almost impossible, I feel like.
I know. Like right now, that's what I need for Robinhood because I have not invested in some very good stocks. I need that 10% return, but whatever.
So they were using professionals already for these services, but he made them believe that he was better than them and they needed to switch over. He would have them use his companies in order to give them advice on their finances and so forth. Mm-hmm. He then convinced Mr. Vadrines to sell the family chateau, saying it was too dangerous for the family. He also made them sell 7 other properties.
Why was it too dangerous?
That's a great question.
Oh, no.
I'm glad you asked. So he brainwashed the family into believing that they were a vital link to a sacred order. It was like an offshoot of the Knights Templar, And it was called The Blue Light and also called The Balance of the World. And of course, he was a part of this secret organization.
Of course he was.
This organization, though, is only activated when there's extreme moments of peril. So when the world's in danger, they come out to help everybody.
Interesting.
They were led by Jacques Gonzalez, their master, who Tilly said he received instructions from Jacques, and then he would report back to the family what the instructions were. Their instructions, though, were to search for a trove of riches that Tilly described as so large it could not fit into any room. During this mission, the family lost their money, their jewels, silver, furniture, art, and finally that mansion that they lived in, mm-hmm. they lost that too.
So it's like, he's saying like it's like a national treasure type thing?
Yeah, kind of? Pretty much, okay. Yeah.
Well, doesn't sound like a national treasure to me.
No.
It's all your stuff.
He convinced the family that they were some of the chosen few to restore France to what it used to be. Which is actually kind of sad, because I feel like since they were nobles, pretty much, mm-hmm. they were starting to lose status, because nobility isn't seen as a cool thing back in the 2000s.
Right.
You know?
I mean, honestly, over here in America, they just kind of started talking about, like, the prince and princesses and stuff like that.
Yeah, so, like, this gave them, like, a purpose.
Okay.
So he convinced the family that not were they only a part of the secret organization, but they were targets. There was the Freemasons that were after them.
Oh, no.
So they barricaded themselves in their mansion.
Are the Freemasons in France, too?
They're apparently everywhere. They're the ones that, remember National Treasure, the people that hid the treasure?
Yeah, I thought it was just kind of like an America thing, and like that's why they're on the dollar bill. Well,
no.
I've been educated. My bad. All right, so they hid in their mansion.
Yep, they hid in their mansion, and they cut off all ties to everybody. They would not talk to their neighbors. They would not answer the door. People said that they would look through the front door and they would just see them sitting there with lights off, not doing anything, not talking, nothing.
Wow.
He continued to isolate them from everybody. He continued to give them financial advice and take from their finances for his own profit. And all at this time, they still think that they are doing, you know, something to help save the world.
Mm-hmm.
In 2001, it got to the point where he told them to quit paying their taxes on their house. Yeah.
If somebody ever tells you to stop paying your house's taxes, fire them. It's bad advice.
So then the French authorities literally took away their mansion and had an auction and sold all of the possessions inside.
I wonder how that works. Aren't they like socialist over there in France?
Not to my knowledge. But yeah, so Tilly still has control over this family, and he makes them move to Oxford, England, where they lived in little houses that actually some of them still have rent due, believe it or not.
Wow, to this day?
To this day.
Oh, no.
He had them work odd jobs that were not really in their social ranking. So like we talked earlier, some of them worked at Shell Oil and, you mm-hmm. know, like administrator of a school. And now they're doing things like being a gardener, cook, and cleaners.
Working at the Shell gas station.
Yeah. So, wow. He would take their money and pay for their living expenses that way. The couple's son said, "All of my money I gave to him. I couldn't even buy a Mars bar. That was seen as theft from the family.
Oh.
I couldn't have friends and I couldn't have girlfriends. We were really in our own world." He would mess with the family by making them stay in a dark room without clocks so they didn't know what time it was or how much time had passed, and then would make the family members turn on each other. Christine, who was one of the daughters, had it the worst. She was the one that we talked about at the very beginning. She was confined to her room in the house that they rented with only tea, bread, and biscuits to eat whenever Tilly thought money was being concealed from him.
That would be an awful diet.
It'd be horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily for Christine, she worked at a delicatessen, which is like a little shop that sells like cold cuts.
Like a Starbucks kind of thing.
Kind of, yeah. And when her boss met Tilly, he knew something was off. He knew that he didn't trust him immediately. He saw his cheap clothes and thought the guy was pretty much full of it.
Well, good. I'm glad somebody can sniff out the bullshit.
Yeah. So then the boss helped Christine get back to France to her cousin, since her husband was still in cahoots with Tilly and mm-hmm. the rest of her family. Tilly was arrested in 2009 after Christine told police that she had been violently abused by her family and Tilly because she failed to provide the key to the fortune that he convinced them that she had.
Good for you, Tilly.
Yeah, even after Tilly was arrested, 9 of the family members were still in Oxford. It took a team of professionals to save them. They sent, like, a team of, like, psychiatrists, psychologists, the whole nine yards. And people were comparing them to the People's Temple, which we talked about in one of our first episodes, because they were afraid of them committing a mass suicide. Yeah. So let's talk about Tilly, the real story. He actually grew up in a pretty modest home, but he was known for having a great memory, but still didn't really do well in school. He lived with his parents until he was 30, and all of his businesses failed because he was a scammer.
Clearly.
Yeah. Vincent David, the lawyer that we talked about earlier, was actually one of the people that was involved in one of his scams, and he owed Vincent David a lot of money. So Vincent David was trying to help him get a job. That's why he recommended him to the family.
Oh.
Because he just wanted to get paid.
Okay.
Tilly was jailed for only 8 years for false imprisonment and abusing the weakness of the psychologically vulnerable people at his trial.
So what's the math on that? 2017?
Yeah, so he's already out. And the Vidrines have been interviewed since then. They're still pretty quiet, but they said that he stole 10 years of our lives. But he did more than that. He destroyed everything on the way. And they now all live in social housing.
Oh my gosh. And they were high up there.
Yeah. And they had like this huge mansion. They weren't like super rich, but they were still doing pretty well.
That's insane. So do we know, like, I mean, I know that he said you have to do this. You'll get the return on investment, everything like that. But how do people like Tilly get into people's heads and convince them? Like
that's
that.
The thing about this one that's so weird, and a lot of people have been talking about it and they can't figure it out, but it seems like they just wanted to, like we all do, be able to have money when they retire, or, you know, so of course, like, if someone's going to give me that good of a deal, I'm going to keep giving him money because I think he's going to pay out. And then when he doesn't, he started using that crazy story and gave them like a purpose to band together with him.
And another thing is, I guess, like, they're all business people. And so when somebody's coming up to them and talking a business deal with them, and they're talking the talk and they're walking the walk, and they can convince them to give all this money to them. I mean, I can kind of see it, but it's just crazy that it gets to this point.
Yeah. No, I can't believe it actually did go to that point, especially because all these people are fairly well educated.
Exactly.
Like, it's crazy that they would stoop to this level, but it also shows if you're in a really hard situation, if someone's just there for you, you know, they can totally take advantage of you.
That's insane.
But yeah, so that's the Vidrines, which is a cult within a family. So it's just kind of different.
It really is. Yeah.
I mean, they literally walled themselves off for people for years. So.
Wow. That was a good one. I like that. So the cocktail this week is, spoiler alert, my serial killer has the name Lee in the name.
Got it.
And I was trying to find all these Lee cocktails, but I couldn't find a Lee cocktail that was sounding good. So I went with the next best option. It's called Fuzzy Coconuts in a Banana Hammock. Same thing, right? So in this drink, you pour 1 ounce of Malibu rum, 1/2 ounce of amaretto, 1/2 ounce of 99 banana schnapps, about 1 teaspoon of lime juice, and then fill the rest with sweet and sour. If you use a pint glass, it turns out really well with this formula, I guess.
I love it.
Yes.
It's very good.
It's very good. It's very banana-y, but it has a little tang at the end because of the sweet and sour.
Yeah, perfect for summer, for sure.
Oh, yes. All right, so are you ready to talk about a serial killer?
I'm so ready.
Okay, let me take a drink of my cocktail. In 1984, Coloradian Casey McLeod entered into this world as a brown-haired, blue-eyed baby girl. Her father described her as creative, smart, who's always giggling at something. Although she was surrounded by love from her family, her parents unfortunately fell out of love. At age 4, they ended their marriage and got divorced. She ended up living with her mother, Lori, until high school. Her mother and her began clashing with each other badly. And this was past typical teenager attitude, because she actually ended up moving out of her mom's and moving in with her aunt in Arizona. Not sure why she wanted to just go live with her dad, though.
Yeah, that seems a little excessive, but maybe she didn't have a good relationship with her dad,
Maybe not, that's what I'm thinking. But anyways, this wasn't the best move for Casey. See, in Arizona, she ended up getting into drugs and hanging around the bad kid and just started being a super rebellious teenager. So all during high school, she's like this. But at 18, she becomes a bad bitch and says, you know what? I'm tired of living this way. I'm going to turn my life around. So she graduates from high school, and then her and her mom decide to try and give their relationship a second shot. She moves back to Colorado and with her mom. Casey got a job at Subway as a sandwich artist. And which
I love how they call themselves sandwich artists. It's like bartenders with mixologists.
I know, I had to put that in there. I was like, sandwich artist. And was just trying to make a decent recovery from her past drug life. Unfortunately, while she was at work one day, drugs were found in her bedroom at home. Her mom called her out on it, saying how disappointed she was in her, and basically she'd been lying to her face the entire time that they were trying to reconcile their relationship. They screamed for hours at each other. Casey said that she wasn't lying to her and the drugs weren't hers. Nonetheless, because of her past, Lori did not believe her. Casey was so frustrated that she stormed out of the house.
Yeah, I would be too if they're not really my drugs.
Exactly. But that would be the last time that Lori McLeod ever saw Casey.
That's the worst.
Mm-hmm. Ending, like, on a fight.
I try to never, like, even if I get in a fight with someone, I always try to be like, love you, bye. Like, even though I'm really mad at you.
I hate you right now. One thing that I failed to mention, however, is that when Casey moved in with her mom, it wasn't just the two of them. No, there was a third person living at that house. It was Lori's new boyfriend.
I knew it. It's always the boyfriend.
Scott Lee Kimball. So that's my thing. Can we talk about what's up with all these Lee names? Like, the last episode was Eileen Lee Warnos.
Yeah.
I had a Thomas Lee Dillon.
Apparently you have a thing for Lees right now.
Apparently, but if your middle name is Lee or you have Lee in any part of your name, I'm going to be skeptical of you. Just so you know that. So, who is Scott Lee Kimball? He was born on September 21st, 1966 in Boulder, Colorado. And really, there isn't too much about his childhood. A lady named Tina Godin, who went to school with Scott, said he wasn't one of the popular kids and he was pretty quiet. But a detective on the police force had a different view of Scott's childhood, in his teenage years at least. He said he remembers that there was a time that he responded to a call at Scott's house because Scott had gotten a hold of one of his father's guns and was just shooting out of his home, hitting different houses.
So he's a psycho. Got it.
Exactly. And he's lucky he didn't murder anyone, but at the same time, I really don't think he would have cared. If you're just going to have the audacity to go shooting out of your house.
Yeah, you obviously don't care about human life.
No. But he ended up finishing high school, and that's about it on his childhood. In the early 2000s, he began his life of crime. Scott and his mom started running a check fraud scam at an optometrist office who worked in the same building as his mom.
With his mom?
With his mama. Mama and son activities.
Oh my gosh.
Instead of going on a picnic together or doing a 5K together, let's do a check fraud scam. They stole over $50,000 in fraudulent checks. Sorry, my thing scrolled too fast. So far, I don't see Scott as being the brightest crayon in the box, so he gets caught and he gets sentenced to jail. But nonetheless, the bailiff or warden or judge or whoever is the person responsible for what I'm about to say next isn't the brightest crayon in the box either. On December 18th, 2002, Scott is released from prison. Not for good behavior, but because he got out so he could be an FBI informant.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
So we'll come back to that. So whatever, he's out of jail, he's living his life as an informant, and he goes to the casino one night and meets a lady. This lady kind of gets a weird vibe about him. She asks him if he's ever been to jail or was a felon or anything like that, because you never know these days.
That's true. First three questions, go for it.
They're not going to put that in their Tinder profile. But he's like, oh, honey, no, quite the opposite. I'm actually an informant for the FBI. I'm not a criminal. And they almost hit it off immediately.
Oh, I'm sure. She's like, oh, he's like Pierce Brosnan and, you know, yeah. 007. Like,
yeah. Hey. So he moves in with her only a few months into dating.
Ugh.
This lady is Lori McLeod, a.k.a. Casey McLeod's mother. So let's go back to Casey. Remember how drugs were found in her room?
Mm-hmm.
Scott planted them there. Scott is the reason for their big blowout. Remember how she had a job as a sandwich artist? Scott would be the one to pick her up from the motel she was staying in, since she left the house after her blowout.
Right.
To take her to work daily. She was just getting started as a sandwich artist at Subway, so she didn't have the funds to, you know, buy a car yet.
Well, yeah, Subway is not the most lucrative place.
Yeah. So, Casey did have a boyfriend at the time, who did occasionally stay with her at the motel. One night he was thinking to himself, yo, she was supposed to be off an hour ago, and I'm hungry. I want my meatball marinara sub. That's all I get at Subway. So he calls Subway, and they say that she never showed up for her shift. He then calls her mother, and she's like, we still aren't speaking. So Lori is like, maybe Baby Cake Scott's will know. She tries to call Scott and ask him, who's away for an entire week on a work trip.
Of course he's on a work trip.
Mm-hmm. But he doesn't answer. Shocking, not shocking. When he does return home, again, a week later, Lori fills him in on the news. She asked if he dropped her off at work that day. He replies, no, I went on a hunting trip that morning, remember? I was in the middle of the woods. I didn't drop her off. She probably just wants time for herself. She'll come back around. And I don't know what was in the water at the time in Colorado, or maybe the altitude was too high that it was hard to think clearly, but the police agreed with Scott.
Really?
They said, she's a grown woman, there's no evidence of foul play, give it some time, she'll come back. And then my next bullet point I put, hashtag fight, hashtag argue, hashtag be a restless bitch.
Yeah.
Because if police are saying that you can't file a missing persons report, you know this person, file it anyway.
Like, I agree.
It's crazy. Unfortunately, though, it's clear how much Casey's mom gives a shit about her by what she does next. Scott is like, baby, I know your daughter is missing and all, but I love you. Let's go to Vegas this weekend and get married.
No, no, no.
She says yes.
Of course she does. Of course. She's one of those people that only cares about, like, what, about herself.
Exactly. Clearly she does. So they elope, and they even go on a little honeymoon shortly after they get back to Ralph National Forest in Colorado. So it's 2004 now. Casey didn't come home for Christmas, nor have they heard anything from her. But, I mean, Scott found her necklace in the kitchen randomly one day when he was the only one at home.
Oh my gosh, I hate this lady.
So he told Lori, oh, she's safe. This was her giving us a don't worry about me sign. Which I'm like, no, fucker. She would have called you and said, don't worry about me. So to get on with Lori and Scott's happy life, they decide to start a cattle farm. Scott had a son from a previous relationship. His name was Justin, and he was 10 years old. On a weekend that it was quote-unquote dad's weekend, Justin came over to his dad's house. He was helping him with the farm, and all of a sudden, according to Scott, he hears screaming. Scott runs over to his son, who is underneath a cattle crate. And do you know what one of those things are?
No.
Okay, so I tried to, like, Google image it. So it's basically, like, one of the transportation cages that cattle are in. Like, when you see them on the highway or on the interstate.
And he's underneath of it.
He's underneath of it. I don't know if it was a whole cattle crate because I feel like he would be dead.
Yeah, as I say, that's pretty big.
That's pretty heavy. So maybe it was, like, individual ones. But basically, it's a cow cage is what I'm getting from it. Justin supposedly screamed that it had fell on him and while he was walking by. It was leaning up against a truck. So Scott said he used his adrenaline, like Superman or something like that, and pushed the crate off his 10-year-old son, threw him into the back of his truck, and rushed him to the hospital. Because apparently 911 isn't a thing.
Well, and he's a hero, so.
Exactly. Well, he should have called 911, because on the way to the hospital, Justin fell out of the truck.
Are you serious? How do you even do that?
I guess if you don't have your seatbelt on, you're just going to fall out of the truck. I have no
idea. Does this truck not have doors?
Apparently not. Apparently it's like a Jeep-style truck with no seatbelts. So now he's had excessive blunt force trauma, and he arrives at the hospital, and shockingly, he's still alive. Justin remained in a coma for several weeks afterwards. Slowly, he began to regain consciousness. As the little 10-year-old's vision began getting clear, and he steadily put his thoughts together, he looks up at his mom, who is sitting by his bedside, and tells her that dad, Scott Kimball, pushed a cattle crate on him, then threw him out of the truck on the way to the hospital.
Does not surprise me whatsoever.
I know. He never wanted to see him again, which I don't blame you, Justin. But unfortunately, again, this is all hearsay. He said, she said. There wasn't any proof that Scott did indeed push the crate on him or push him out of the truck. There are no cameras on the farm, no witnesses that saw him push him out of the truck. Police didn't have enough to charge him. Nonetheless, his ride or die Lori sticks by his side.
Lori, get a life.
Lori. But to give some kind of satisfaction, some kind of spoiler alert, she later said in an interview that, quote, I was hoping it was all the craziness that I had created in my head. Which, I mean, at a certain point, Lori.
No excuse, Lori.
Certain point, babe. A bit after all of this happened, Terry Kimball, Scott's uncle, came to live with Scott and Lori for a while for reasons unclear. Maybe he was just older and wanted to stay with his family. But after about a month of staying there, Terry all of a sudden, one day, isn't in the room. Yeah. Terry all of a sudden, one day, isn't in his bedroom, in the kitchen, anywhere in the house. For a few days. So Lori goes up to Scott and she's like, hey, sweetums, where'd your uncle go? Scott casually replies, oh, you didn't hear? Terry won the lottery. He moved to Mexico a few days ago with a stripper named Ginger.
No, he didn't.
Swear.
Oh my gosh. That's, yeah. Well, doesn't surprise me.
Well, my thing is, like, if I were Lori, I would be like, you couldn't bring this up over dinner one night. This would have made nice conversation. Or Terry wouldn't say bye to me or anything like that.
I mean, he was just using her.
Yeah,
so
clearly.
He wanted to get out with not much drama at all.
Exactly.
He found a good way,
yeah.
So.
Yeah. Whatever, she brushes it off. After all, a year later, after Terry's disappearance, Terry sent an email to the family saying, hey guys, I'm doing great. Don't worry about me. I'm living my life with Ginger, and I have no plans on coming back.
Don't worry. We won't worry about you.
It's fine. It's all fine. Going back to his roots, Scott decides to commit check fraud again through his cattle company. He was surely caught by whoever he tried to scam shortly after, and the police were called. When they arrived at the Kimball residence, Lori is like, oh, I don't know where he is. He could be in California or Alaska, but he's not here. Which I'm like, way to be specific.
Yeah.
About that. So police do a little digging on Scott, seeing what this guy is about. They see police reports from Casey. And they see that there is one for Terry because his family members were like, no, he didn't just disappear. Like, that's crazy. And there is one more police report about him, connecting him not to one, not to two, but to three missing people. Her name was Leanne Emery. So we're going to go back in the past a couple of years.
Okay.
Leanne Emery was described as a determined girl. And if she wanted something done, she would get it done. Not surprisingly, she was in college for physical therapy, but then decided that she loved animals so much that she wanted to follow her heart and become a vet tech. Unfortunately, her mom had some health issues that came up, and Leanne decided that her mom was more important than her education, so she dropped out when she was about halfway through. Since she was taking care of her mom so much, she ended up losing her job from calling in so much. And I mean, dropping out of school, losing your job, these are huge life events. They can really drag a person down. Which is why, unfortunately, she started hanging out with the wrong crowd. So just to kind of give you an idea of the crowd that she hung out with, she actually married a man who was already incarcerated.
So she married him while he was in jail?
Yeah.
Okay, pen pal, got it.
Mm-hmm, got it. She told her parents that she was going on a trip to Mexico with her friends for 1, maybe 2 weeks. This was something that Leanne did probably once a year, so this wasn't a red flag or anything. And honestly, in my opinion, like, homegirl needed a break.
Yeah, I would go to Mexico too.
Yeah, taking care of her mom so much, losing her job, everything like that. She left on January 16th, 2003. A couple hours after she left, she called her sister saying, if anything happens to me, I just want you to know that I love you. Her sister says, what? What are you talking about? She repeats herself, they talk for a little while longer, and then they hang up. 11 days later, she calls her dad and says that she's going to stay in Mexico a little while longer and don't worry about her. But that was the last time that anyone ever heard from Leanne. Leanne's dad gets a call from her incarcerated boyfriend, or I guess husband. He's like, yeah, I think she's in trouble. I haven't heard from her. You all need to call the FBI and file a missing persons report.
At least he knows what's going on.
Exactly. But, lo and behold, the FBI's like, yeah, this guy's a criminal. He can't be trusted. Don't listen to him. Her parents end up filing a missing persons report anyways. Security cameras last saw Leanne checking out of a motel on January 30th, 2003, in Colorado. Meaning, when she called her dad saying she was going to stay in Mexico a little while longer, she was in Colorado the whole time.
with our guy?
Maybe. And her credit cards had also been used after, like, everybody has heard from her. When the news of her disappearance gets to her family, her cousin immediately goes to the police and informs them that before she left, she told her about some guy named Hannibal.
And okay, wait. Hannibal?
Exactly.
I'm sorry, but if your name's Hannibal, we're not dating.
We're not even being friends. No. Your name is Hannibal. Saying that she has to hide from him and that he's a dangerous person. So police are like, cool, we find Hannibal, we find our guy. Turns out, this Hannibal guy was an inmate in prison with Leanne's incarcerated boyfriend. They were best jail buddies. They even talked about escaping and meeting Leanne in Mexico, where she was supposedly going on vacation with her friends. Guess who the jail cell inmate was?
Our man.
Our man. So Scott does have communication with Leanne because it's his best jail buddy's girlfriend, or wife, I mean, and it's like, look, if we're all three going to be in on this, you and I need to be in communication as well. So they talk, communicate, and Scott is happy. I mean, he's got a best jail bud, and he was soon to be out of there from escaping. He goes back to his cell to where his cellmate, Stephen Innes, resided. Although not as close as he and Leanne's husband was, they still shoot the shit. After all, they are stuck together almost all day, every day. One day, Stephen is all worked up. Scott's like, yo, man, what's up? And Stephen starts telling him how he and his girlfriend, Jennifer Markham, are going to hire somebody to murder a snitch that is going to testify against him. Stephen is in jail for dealing ecstasy. He had a 10-year prison sentence, and this dude was going to make him be in prison even longer. He couldn't have that. So Scott's like, cool, 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 cool. So remember how I said how Scott got out of prison for being an FBI informant?
Right.
So this was that occurrence.
Oh.
So he went to the FBI and he was like, hey, so my roomie over here is trying to kill someone for testifying against him. You let me out and I'll be your informant.
Makes sense. Smart move.
Although check fraud is a pretty serious offense, in the FBI's minds, murder was worse.
I agree.
Yeah. So they comply with Scott and they let him go. So as a reminder, earlier when Scott committed check fraud at the optometrist office with his mom, he was released from prison on December 18th, 2002. Casey left for Mexico on January 16th, 2003. Literally a month's difference from the time he gets out to the time that she goes missing. Scott knew her number. Scott knew where she lived. They were in communication with each other.
Right.
Anyways, fulfilling his obligation to the FBI still, Scott looks into Jennifer, whose last name was Markham, like I already said. But Jennifer Markham was a 25-year-old single mom of a 5-year-old son. She worked as a stripper named Francesca, which relates to your story, at a place called Shotgun Willie's.
All right.
Sounds like a classy strip club. Kind of sounds like a country one.
Oh, yeah. It has to be themed. There's no way it's not.
I wonder if they wear cowgirl hats there. She began prostituting as well to make ends meet. Jennifer was last seen on February 17th, 2003, near the Denver airport. There was no evidence that she ever got on any flight. So remember before I started talking about Leanne and Jennifer's disappearances, the police were looking into Scott Kimball on check fraud. And remember how Lori, his wife, told police that he was either in California or Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
They ended up finding him in California, and they do a police chase through Coachella, which is kind of a fun
really?
Fact. Yeah. The only reason that the chase gets stopped is because Scott ran out of gas. So that's how the police caught him.
Rookie move.
Exactly. He gets sentenced to several years in jail, again, for check fraud. So by the time they're really digging in to Scott, he's still in jail. They end up getting a search warrant and search Scott's belongings, including his computer. On it, they find pictures of Leanne. So deny all he wants, but police now know for a fact that they know each other.
Right.
They also look into Terry Kimball, the uncle that had won the lottery and supposedly had run away to Mexico with his stripper lover, Ginger. Turns out, shocking not shocking, he won the lottery in Ohio, and the Ohio lottery had never had any record of him winning.
Okay, makes sense.
And I don't think that this was questioned too much when he did disappear, because remember, they were living in Colorado. So, I mean, he's saying that he won the lottery from Ohio. They're not going to, like, kind of look into it too
right,
much.
Right, who would, yeah, so far.
Right. But regardless, as all of us true crime fans know well by now, nobody.
No crime.
Exactly. So, although in jail for check fraud, police go to ask him about the women. They're basically like, listen, you could deny it all you want, but we've been looking into you. You're our prime suspect for not one, not two, not even three, but four missing people. The more you work with us, the better your result from all this is going to be. Scott sits there for a minute in silence. Officers can tell that he's racking that small brain of his, trying to think of something credible to say. Finally, he sputters out the words, what if one of the girls disappeared on National Forest land?
Really?
And the police are like, well, that's a fucking weird question to ask. But one of the agents' light bulbs clicks in his head. He recalls a receipt that had been kept in evidence that dated back to August 24th, 2003, the day after Casey disappeared. Where was this receipt from, you ask? Route National Forest in Colorado.
That's some good detective work and a good memory.
Exactly. But that's where they went on their honeymoon.
Asshole.
So, police go to the ranger, or Smokey the Bear, or whoever it was, and ask if they found anything particular that could be related to human remains. And the ranger's like, well, golly, yeah. Last year, in the fall of 2007, hunters found a skull in the forest. A human skull. And so they're like, why didn't you tell anyone? Which I just imagine them being like, I don't know, I thought it was cool.
Yeah, right. It's in our nature shop. What are you talking about?
This is the emblem that makes everybody come in. So they had the skull, they gave it over to the police, and through DNA testing, it was proved to be the skull of Casey McLeod.
Wow.
So police are now like, okay, we got him for this one, but we need to get him to admit to the other three. They do this by striking a deal, and this deal really irks me. Scott said he would plead guilty to two counts of second-degree murder and get 28 years if he told police where the bodies were. Which, my thing is, that's like literally 7 years per murder.
Yeah, that's not enough. I know people really want closure and they want to know where the bodies are, but do you want someone to possibly get out, you know, like when they commit such a like horrible crime?
No, I'd want them to rot in prison forever. So, Scott takes the deal. He draws a map to all the bodies. The first, or I guess second, murder is Uncle Terry. Terry's mummified body was found in a remote area of Vail Pass, which is basically a path in the mountains of Colorado, right where Scott said he would be. His hands were tied together with a rope. The third murder is of Leanne Emery. Leanne's skeletal remains were found in the fetal position.
Oh my gosh.
In Books Cliffs region near the Colorado border, again, right where Scott said she would be. Her body was wrapped in a sleeping bag, plastic bag, and duct tape. A bullet was found near her body that matched a bullet from a Scott. A bullet was found near her body, and it matched a bullet from a gun that Scott apparently used to own. I just can't imagine finding somebody dead in the fetal position.
No, that's horrible.
That broke my heart. The fourth murder is Jennifer Markham. Scott drew a map to a specific path in the mountains. Police looked all over the place, north, south, east, west, and they just could not find a body. So they confront Scott about this, and he's like, well, it was dark, and I was only there once, so I don't know. They never found Jennifer. Jennifer is still missing to this day.
They didn't find her, no deal. That'd be my rule about it.
You're smart. The last that she was seen was in Denver, near the airport, on February 16th, 2003. She is a white female who is 5 feet 6 inches tall with brown hair and blue eyes. Jennifer had breast implants and an IUD, which I only say that because these are specific factors that could identify her. Today, she would be in her early 40s. Her mother, Mary Willis, is quoted saying, Jennifer fell through the cracks. She wasn't important enough. She was a dancer. She was an escort. She wasn't important enough. And I don't think the FBI cared, period. It's all got to do with drugs and money.
Yeah.
Which, I agree with her. But, you know, we care, Jennifer. To this day, her parents are still offering a $20,000 reward for the information to her whereabouts. Across the top of her missing poster ad, or missing persons ad, it reads, Jennifer, where are you? If any of our listeners do have any information about Jennifer Markham, we encourage you to call Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-STOP. So it's kind of like a rumor that Scott Kimball confessed to the murder of Jennifer to get a better deal.
I could see that.
But, I mean, if he did or not is unclear, but regardless, like you said, he didn't hold up his side of the deal. So, police basically give him two middle fingers. So, he does get sentenced to 28 years, like he said, but they also add on an additional 48 years.
Good.
For other charges.
Good.
These charges include check fraud and a federal gun charge because of the bullet that was found near Leanne's body. So, adding that all together, it's a total of 76 years. He is still alive and in the Colorado State Penitentiary. He will be eligible for parole in 2044. So, parole board, are you listening?
Yeah, that's not that far away.
Don't grant this twat waffle anything. He doesn't deserve to be out. Today, he is 54 years old. Just so everyone knows, Lori finally wised up and she got her marriage annulled by Scott.
Good.
So they're no longer married. Scott wrote a 147-page letter to his family in 2014. He said that Casey died by accident by an overdose of drugs and alcohol. He said Jennifer also overdosed on drugs, specifically heroin, which, again, we still don't know if he murdered her or not.
Yeah, what a coincidence. All these people are dying from overdoses.
Exactly. But actually, the last one, he said that Leanne was trying to escape from him, so he just shot her and, like, lost control. And he never said anything about Uncle Terry. To me, this sounds like he's just trying to be like, oh, I'm not a bad guy. Like, they just overdosed on drugs, and I just lost control one time on the other one.
Right. Like, it was just a spur of the moment thing.
Exactly. I'm not a bad guy. I made a mistake. But of course, like all other POS serial killers, he keeps confessing to killing people. Dozens. I don't know why they always do that, but he confessed to killing another prostitute and dumped her body in a dumpster in someone's backyard. This matched Katrina Powell, who was a prostitute found in a dumpster in someone's backyard.
Wow.
Her hands were cut off. Her murderer was never caught. He is also a suspect in a Jane Doe case where her fingers were cut off and an intricate knot was used to tie the victim up, which was the same intricate knot found with Uncle Terry. So I don't know what this knot was specifically, and I don't know, since there's not a lot about his childhood, I don't know, like, if he was in, like,
Boy Scouts,
or I think they tie knots in the Navy or something, but she was also packaged the same way as Leanne Emery was.
Mm.
Detectives are quoted saying, there's a lot of small circumstantial pieces that link him to the victim, but there's not enough there. We don't have enough to move forward on this case. The last one, and I will not go too much into it because this will be a 4-hour episode and nobody has time for that, is that he is a suspect in the West Mesa murders. And I don't want to tell you guys too much about it since I will be covering it someday, but Scott was arrested around the time that these murders had stopped. But that is the story of Scott Lee Kimball.
I love that one. I've never heard of him before.
I'm really surprised I've never heard of him.
Yeah, he's not very famous. I mean, I don't want anyone to ever be famous for this type of stuff, but right. You never hear about him.
Right. And, like, you think of all, like, the big serial killers, like John Wayne Gacy and Ted Bundy, and, like, yeah, they killed a lot of people, and he supposedly only killed 4, but he beat up his son. Like, he's a dangerous person. We should know more about him.
No, I agree.
So, yeah, that was the wild Colorado ride.
I loved it. That was good. That was really good.
Thanks. Well, thank you guys for listening again. Be sure to follow us on Instagram. The handle is Cults, Killers, and Cocktails.
And if you have any ideas or have something you want us to cover or just any comments, feel free to DM us or just leave a comment on our Instagram.
Again, tell us if we're wrong. We've got tough skin. We'll take it.
Especially if I mispronounce something this week, because I know I definitely have. So.
And we don't mean to offend anybody by that. So call us out. Yell at us. But don't make us cry. All right.
Thanks. See you next week.
Thanks. Bye.